Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
It's after the hour. My name is Lee Rayburn, broadcasting from the Air America affiliate, the Mike 92.1 in Madison, Wisconsin. Happy to have you along for the ride, and am I the only one that struggles with trying to imagine Tom Hartman and Rachel Maddow on a cruise? I just, in Bermuda shorts, having met Tom Hartman, I know what a, you know, dapper guy he is. It's a pleasure to be sitting in for him today and tomorrow, and there is so much on our plate to get to. First of all, anybody at the Prop Hate rallies, I'm looking forward to hearing from you once we get the phones back up, which is going to happen sooner or later. Once we do, we'll take your calls. Also coming up today, Media Matters joins us to take a look at what the local right-wing talk show hosts are saying about the president-elect Barack Obama. You may be surprised, and again, like most communities, if you have a right-wing talk show host, local talk show host in your community, you probably already have a good guess that he is a Muslim with a terrible Christian minister. Of course! Also, the Big Three bailout. Will the auto workers and auto manufacturers in the United States be given the same treatment as Wall Street and airplanes and commuter rail? I'll give you one good guess. We'll hear from that. Barack Obama last night on 60 Minutes in his first interview. And was it me or was that just the softest interview you've ever seen with a president-elect? So tell us about your dog and your mother-in-law. Really? No. Tell us about what's going to happen with Iraq and Afghanistan. Tell us what's going to happen with our local economy and who we won't bail out and how we socialize losses while continuing to privatize profit. No, do tell. And then let's focus on your future dog and current mother-in-law. I think my favorite story of the weekend came from Glenn Greenwald, who posted this at Salon.com, and it is beautiful. It has to do with the remnants of the Bush administration. The Bush administration has now been used as a reason not to do something. French President Nicolas Sarkozy saved the president of Georgia from being hanged, pardon my French here, by the balls, that's a quote, a threat that was made last summer by Vladimir Putin. This according to an account that emerged in a French paper. And the French paper quoted Sarkozy as telling Vladimir Putin, hang him, he asked. Why not? Putin replied. The Americans hanged Saddam Hussein. And after a brief pause, Sarkozy responded by telling Vladimir Putin, yeah, but you don't want to end up like President Bush. Probably ended one of those with one of those French uh-huh, at the end. Uh-huh, don't want to end up like. And that's my French accent, which is why I won't use it ever again. And so to which Putin replied, ah, you've scored a point there. Yeah, the president of Georgia was saved by President Bush, or at least the example of President Bush. You don't want to see, when it comes to foreign policy, you don't want to be like W. And I don't care if you're the ruler with the iron fist in the former nation, land of the Iron Curtain. But, brother, you do not want to be like George W. Speaking of which, hey, it's called Iraqocracy, and it's like democracy, only more explosive-y. A suicide bomber killed 15 people and injured 20 others in an attack on a police checkpoint in Jalawa, northeast of Baghdad, over the weekend in the Diyala province. Seven of the victims happened to be Baghdad police officers. Oh, no, I'm sorry. The war is over and we've won. My mistake. I don't know where this information is coming from then. Oh, yeah, the media. Three people were killed in another roadside bomb explosion in northeast Baghdad yesterday morning, targeting a Sunni group that has been cooperating with the Iraqi government. Two of the people who died were members of this Sunni group. Right now, we are in the middle of deliberations about a withdrawal of troops from Iraq. And I can't believe this isn't getting more attention. Iraq's cabinet over the weekend approved a security pact setting a timetable for the nearly complete withdrawal of American forces within the next 3 years. Did I read that right? Is that McClatchy newspaper has called it a timetable? I do believe that one of those Barack Obama Muslim terrorists with a bad Christian minister timetables has now been ratified by the Bush administration. They are now waiting for the Iraqi parliament to sign off on it, and it may not happen in the 275-member Iraqi parliament. The Iraq cabinet voted in favor of it almost unanimously, with one person voting no and a handful of others abstaining from the vote. The largest Sunni party in Iraq, the Iraqi Islamic Party, is openly complaining that their efforts to amend the plan to require the release of detainees and provide compensation for war victims have been ignored by Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, who helped shape the pact. And it's almost worse than that. Muqtada al-Sadr, one of the leading clerics in Iraq, has opposed it outright because he wants American troops out now. 27 of the 28 cabinet members supported the withdrawal proposal within 3 years. However, 9 members of the cabinet refused to vote. The Shiite cleric Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani also gave the withdrawal plans a green light on Saturday. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's party, the Dawa Party, framed the deal as a means to end American occupation for good. Also in this agreement, which still has yet to be ratified by the Iraqi parliament, would require the U.S. to get Iraqi consent before searching homes. That would be a big change, as our own troops have come home now and told the reports of their job, which has been to go into houses and find the young men and detain them until they can find out whether or not. This has to do with the Cheney 1% doctrine. If there's a 1% chance, you grab them. And that's what our troops have done as ordered. It would also, this agreement, and I thought this was a big surprise, give Iraqis authority over the Green Zone? Whoa! That is the center of American power in Baghdad. However, under this agreement, that center of American power would be given Iraqi sovereignty for the first time since we invaded March 2003. Oh, it seems like so long ago now. It would also enable Iraqis, this is a change of pace, to search U.S. cargo, where American troops have been searching everything coming into Iraq. Now Iraqis are going to be able to begin searching everything that the U.S. is bringing into their country. It would also prohibit Americans from conducting raids in other countries from Iraqi soil. I thought international law prohibited that, but after we entered into Syria from Iraq and Pakistan from Afghanistan, I guess international law is, what's the word? Quaint. It would also eliminate judicial immunity. So foreign contractors now that kill with impunity will no longer be immune. U.S. soldiers working in Iraq under the current mandate would no longer be immune to crimes they commit in country. This agreement is set to replace the U.N. mandate, allowing American forces to stay in Iraq, but that mandate only goes through the end of the year, on December 31st, where our troops would be in Iraq without this agreement, without any sort of ratification through the international community, international law, the Iraqi government, or even our own U.S. government. And, maybe most importantly, this agreement leaves no room, none, to extend the American presence in Iraq beyond December 31st, 2011, giving it a solid three-year deadline from the end of this year. Nice math. It calls on American units to begin pulling out of Iraqi cities by June of next year, and we are all out by the end of the year in 2011. The timetable is final and fixed. However, as the Iraqi foreign minister told CNN yesterday, there is still a lot of work to do, and this deal is far from done. This is Iraqi Foreign Minister Zabari.
There is no deal until there is a deal. It's not over until it's over. So we have a very, very critical time next week.
He goes on to say there is still much to be done, and there is a question as to whether it will be ratified by the 275-member Iraqi parliament.
A lot of work to do within the next week and 10 days to make sure that all the leaders of the parliamentary blocs are on board, and this would be passed smoothly.
Barack Obama on 60 Minutes last night addressed what he will do as the president in Iraq, what his foreign policy will be, and here's a shocker, it'll be exactly what he said it would be while he was running to be our president.
Can you give us some sense of when you might start redeployments out of Iraq?
Well, I've said during the campaign, and I stick to this commitment, that as soon as I take office, I will call in the Joint Chiefs of Staff, my national security apparatus, and we will start executing a plan that draws down our troops, particularly in light of the problems that we're having in Afghanistan, which has continued to worsen.
Iraqi parliament could vote as early as Wednesday if they can get them all together on this new agreement to keep our troops only in Iraq until the end of 2011. Lawmakers here at home could vote as early as next week, right before Thanksgiving, as to whether or not they will sign on to it. There is really no contention as to whether or not the U.S. government will ratify this agreement. Iraq's government has received U.S. assurances that President-elect Obama would honor the agreement. Each side would have the right to repeal it. However, we will see what happens. Now, clearly, Iran and Syria have openly opposed the pact, partly because Syria has already been invaded by American troops in Iraq. They are arguing for the immediate withdrawal, as is Muqtada al-Sadr. But Barack Obama has another plan, 16 months and we're done. We will see what happens with that when we return. We'll see what's happening in Afghanistan. Developments today suggest that Afghanistan may be on the brink. What are we going to do about that? We are facing problems on every front. Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman today. This is Air America Radio.
You're listening to Lee Rayburn, filling in on the Tom Hartman program.
Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman today. Happy to be with you. And, you know, once our economy started going into the crapper, I think it was interesting to see how much attention was deflected from our international incidents that we have, our ongoing occupations and wars. Our foreign policy itself seemed to fall by the wayside. However, if we took a step back, wouldn't it be obvious that part of the reason we can't fix our budget shortfalls in 41 of the 50 states from coast to coast isn't part of the reason that we are seeing our economy collapse underneath our feet? Isn't part of the reason our foreign policy itself, with $12 billion a month spent on Iraq, with possibly $3 trillion spent on wars that were, by all accounts except for W's himself, unnecessary to begin with and unending, to say the least? Don't you think there's a connection there? We will certainly talk about the economy and whether or not to save the big three, that are American auto manufacturers, in the hours to come. However, starting on foreign policy today, because I tend to believe that there is an interconnection between what we are facing at home in our economic crisis and the amount of money we are pouring into keeping wars going overseas. Am I wrong? Yesterday, Afghani President Hamid Karzai said that he would guarantee the security of Taliban chief Mullah Muhammad Omar if he decides to enter into peace talks. This is how unstable Afghanistan has become. Hamid Karzai is looking like he can no longer rely on our NATO troops overseas right now, and is forced to, in order for the sake and stability of the and future security of Afghanistan, is turning to the terrorists for help. Karzai said during a news conference in the Afghan capital of Kabul yesterday that he would not bow to demands from the international community to turn over Mohammed Omar to U.S. authorities if the Taliban leader agreed to negotiate a peace settlement. The Washington Post had this yesterday. Karzai said this: if I say I want protection for Mullah Omar, the international community has two choices: remove me or leave. Well, I guess that goes to the heart of Afghani democracy. I wasn't elected by the Afghani people. I was elected by the international community. Read oil and gas interests. After all, that's where he came from. Now, Muhammad Omar, Mullah, is prominent on the list of U.S.-designated global terrorists. He is on that list. He is on the deck of cards. Omar rose to power in all the number threes that we have now killed or apprehended. Number one and number two are still out there. And Hamid Karzai wants to talk to them peacefully. Omar rose to power in Kandahar in Afghanistan in the early to mid-90s after the Soviets could no longer fight in Afghanistan. And the impending civil war that broke out empowered Mullah Omar, who to a point now where he is seen by many to be more powerful than the president himself, Hamid Karzai. Karzai went on to say yesterday his government's willing to talk with any insurgent group that agrees to respect the Afghan constitutions. However, groups involved with al-Qaeda are out of the question, Karzai said. Is Mullah Omar, is he not involved with al-Qaeda? I thought he was on the top of the list. Am I just confusing al-Qaeda with the Taliban? Now, this goes part and parcel with what else we're facing. And Barack Obama also talking about changes that could be made just with the flip of his pen, January 20th, 2009, in terms of our foreign policy. Like the lawless area we call Guantanamo Bay. Like the enhanced interrogation techniques. That sweet little name we gave for what could be called any other name, a rose by any other name, would smell as sweet. This would be torture or enhanced interrogation techniques. Same thing. What would Obama do last night on 60 Minutes?
There are a number of different things that you could do early pertaining to executive orders.
Right.
One of them is to shut down Guantanamo Bay.
Mm-hmm.
Another is to change interrogation methods that are used by U.S. troops. Are those things that you plan to take early action on?
Yes. I have said repeatedly that I intend to close Guantanamo, and I will follow through on that. I've said repeatedly that America doesn't torture, and I'm going to make sure that we don't torture.
Nice. God, what a breath of fresh air. Not couching it in those W talking points. We're going to do what we got to do, smoke them out of their holes. Dead or alive, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, give me another line of blow. The story last Thursday that I thought was completely missed was our director of the CIA, General Michael Hayden, last Thursday acknowledging that there were dangers during a presidential transition when new officials were coming in and getting accustomed to the challenges. However, he went on to say there nothing specific has been mentioned. Oh, God, we've gone through this before. But then again, there is some historic precedent. And you go back to 1993, Clinton's first year in office, when the first bombing of the World Trade Center occurred. You go back to 2001, George W. Bush's first year in office, when the falling, you know what happened. Yeah. So what about Barack Obama's first year in office? Remember Joe Biden on the campaign trail taking his foot and putting it firmly inside his mouth, saying in the first 6 months Barack Obama will be tested, and then having that used against Barack Obama by the McCain campaign? Well, it looks like at least the CIA director is not poo-pooing that possibility. The Home Office Security Minister, I got the story from the London Times, and the British Home Office Security Minister spoke recently of a quote-unquote huge threat, saying, quote, there's another great plot building up again, and we are monitoring this, end quote, without specifics. General Hayden said that Al-Qaeda remained a determined and adaptive enemy, operating from its safe haven in Pakistan, adding if there's a major attack on this country, it will bear the fingerprints of Al-Qaeda. Barack Obama has a lot to get ready for, not the least of which is John McCain coming to the transition office today to speak with the president-elect. Media Matters when we continue. Lee Rayburn for Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
This is Lee Rayburn, guest hosting on the Tom Hartman program.
Minutes after the hour, my name is Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Tom Hartman today as he enjoys his Air America cruise with the rest of the crew. Joining us this afternoon over the phone, the senior fellow for Media Matters online at MediaMatters.org, Paul Waldman. Good morning. Good afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon.
Hey, happy to speak with you again. And it's interesting today, me sitting in for a national talk show host, being a local progressive talk show host in Madison, Wisconsin, and seeing the Media Matters report from late last week detailing the right-wing hate speech that we are hearing nationwide on local right-wing talk radio. How bad is it getting right now, Paul?
It's getting pretty bad, and I think the election of a Democratic president is going to make it, if anything, worse than it has been. A lot of people don't realize it. Even people who listen to talk radio with the big famous national hosts, even those on the right like Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity, I mean, they say a lot of terrible things, and we document them at our website, MediaMatters.org, all the time. But there's a lot of other stuff that flies under a lot of people's radar.
Yep.
That is even more vitriolic, even more consumed with conspiracy theories, and even more hateful in some cases.
Paul, in my backyard, there was recently an expose just last week in Milwaukee Magazine of a former right-wing talk show host, radio producer, just basically blowing the format out of the water, detailing how the whole goal is to make people feel isolated, alone, and make them feel like their only point of recourse is to listen to that talk show host. That's how it works. That's how they operate. Which, you know, is foreign to me, because I always thought, well, our goal here is to create community, bring people together, and destroy this myth that they are alone and there's nothing they can do about it.
Yeah, well, what you're trying to do is more difficult. It's harder to make people feel that sense of community, to give them hope, to give them something to fascinate them. All of those things that really a good radio host can accomplish are difficult. It's much easier to make people feel angry and afraid. And anger and fear are really the fuel that drives so much of conservative talk radio across the country. You know, the best way to get a sense of it is probably to just drive from one end of the country to the other and keep your radio tuned. And you will hear that every single town you encounter has, its own kind of low-rent Limbaugh who feels that the way to be successful is to, just target people like women and minorities and immigrants and drum up hatred and fear about them. And sometimes, the last time I drove across the country, it seemed like all you had to do to get your own show on the radio was to be willing to get on the air and call Hillary Clinton a lesbian.
Well, and it's interesting that you say that, because Media Matters has compiled a list of some of the local talk show hosts and what they've been saying since the election. And it's scary. I mean, the first time I heard this, it made me feel creepy. It made me feel like I was listening to something that I shouldn't hear. Let's just play this. Paul Waldman, our guest, senior fellow at MediaMatters.org.
Obama wants to gas the Jews, like the PLO wants to gas the Jews.
He loathes America.
He's palling around with terrorists. This little bitch needs to stand up for himself.
What do you got to do, Obama? Come to Denver and try to whip my white ass? You're a far-left, terrorist-hugging politician.
This is the first affirmative action election in American history.
He's Arab.
The Statue of Liberty is crying. She's been raped and disheveled. Raped and disheveled. By illegal aliens.
I'll give you an example. I don't think homeless people should vote, frankly. In fact, I'm not that excited about women voting.
That's what black fathers do. They simply leave. Barack Hussein Obama. I may declare him to be the beast. 666.
Wow. That is some nasty hyperbole.
Yeah, and that's what is being sent out over the airwaves every single day. On conservative talk radio, in some cases by local hosts who may only be on one station, and some by people who are syndicated to a few stations or a couple of dozen stations, and in some cases by nationally syndicated hosts.
Well, I heard Savage in there. He's hard to miss.
Yeah, and he's on hundreds of stations. You know, just in the last couple of days, you had G. Gordon Liddy, who is, as an aside, every bit the unrepentant terrorist that William Ayers is. You had G. Gordon Liddy go on the air and encourage his listeners to break the law. They were talking about the possibility of new gun laws, and Liddy told them that no matter what laws they pass, I'm quoting here, no matter what laws they pass, do not repeat, not ever register any of your firearms. You know, the idea there is that we're about to enter some kind of an apocalypse, and people need to hold on to their guns to keep themselves from the coming dictatorship. But he's telling people to break the law, and this is the same guy who told his listeners that if federal agents come to their door, they should shoot them in the head because they wear bulletproof vests.
Paul Waldman, I know from my experience in talk radio that any time anybody challenges the safety or security of the president, that the Secret Service swoops in. Even if it's a stupid caller that calls in and is angry and misplaced and misguided, the Secret Service is there. But when you have the actual host now practicing not just hate speech, but threatening speech against the president-elect, what does that mean?
It's really kind of a poisoning of our discourse. You know, obviously, we all believe in the First Amendment very strongly. I think that people should have a right to say whatever they want to. Obviously, threats don't qualify as that. That's something that's never been you can always be punished for. But as a general matter, people should have the right to express strong opinions, and they should express strong opinions. That's what contributes to the vitality of a democracy. But there's something else that happens with a lot of this rhetoric. It's so sort of eliminationist, the idea that people who disagree with you aren't just people who are wrong. They're actually your enemies. That's one of the kind of running themes of so much of the conservative talk radio.
Enemies, heck, Paul, they're the Antichrist.
Exactly. And so what it means is that you can't engage into a debate with people like that. If people are your enemy or they are supporting terrorists or they may even be the Antichrist, well, that's not somebody you have a debate with. That's just somebody who has to be destroyed.
What an interesting point of contrast is we see Barack Obama meeting with John McCain today, trying to heal old wounds and bring everybody together for the work that needs to be done on behalf of this country. Last week, Barack Obama meeting with his primary challenger, his Senator Hillary Clinton, trying to heal the wounds and bring folks together for the task at hand. Meanwhile, you have, and as the Center for American Progress pointed out last year, along with Free Press, in the top 10 radio markets, 76% of the programming in those markets is conservative. So almost over three-fourths of what you're getting in the big media markets right now is the right-wing point of view, which is, as we heard, is hateful and, if not, threatening to the president-elect.
Yeah, and what happens in the small markets, it's even more tilted toward conservatives. And so this kind of poisons the whole debate by making it impossible for people to ever have any kind of agreement, even if there's some areas in which they disagree. And, you know, one of the ironies about this is you might remember during the primary campaign when Clinton and Obama were battling it out, one of the arguments that I don't think the Obama campaign may or may not have said this, but certainly a lot of Obama partisans said this, that, well, you know, if Hillary Clinton is the nominee, then, boy, the right wing is really going to go after her. And that was one of the things that they said. Now, obviously, now here we are. Obama just survived one of the most extraordinary campaigns of character assassination I think any politician has ever encountered.
Agreed.
It is going to get, if anything, even worse over the course of his presidency. You know, the conspiracy theories were out there during the campaign that he wasn't really born in Hawaii and he's not really an American. And
Savage saying that last week.
Yeah, I'm still
questioning
saying that.
Questioning the death of his grandmother.
Yeah, when Bill Clinton, Savage has basically implied that he killed his grandmother for some reason. When Bill Clinton was president, they said that he had murdered dozens of his political enemies and that he ran a drug running operation out of an airport in Arkansas. And so who knows what kind of things they're going to come up with over the next 4 or 8 years about Barack Obama.
And it's so clear, Paul, to me that they've painted Barack Obama, the president-elect, into this corner that he cannot climb himself out of. Because, number one, his middle name is Hussein, and he's a Muslim, but he's got that nasty Christian minister from Chicago, Jeremiah Wright, that he is this Marxist socialist that is bringing socialism into the White House. But at the same time, let me see here, he's also campaigned from the center right, so he needs to now be the president of the center right as a socialist Marxist. You see, they put him in a position where no matter what move he makes, he can't win.
Yeah, and the contradictions and the arguments don't seem to bother anybody who's making them. You know, when he was running, as you said, he was supposedly a socialist and maybe a Marxist. And then literally a few days later after he won, some of those same people were saying, well, you know, he really ran this sort of centrist campaign, so he has no mandate to actually enact any progressive change.
It's so stupid. And yet people are buying it because people are listening to the Rush Bows of the world and the Billows of the world and the Michael Savages of the world. For what, though? So they can feel alone? So they can feel like that their president is the Antichrist? Is that why they listen?
I don't know. But I think that what we saw with Clinton is one thing we're going to see again, that they never really accepted the legitimacy of Bill Clinton's election.
Right.
The idea that he was actually the president of all Americans was something that they could not accept. And there was a move in Congress to impeach him before anyone had heard the name Monica Lewinsky. So I think we're going to see the same kind of thing, that they will find reasons why Obama's presidency is not legitimate, and I don't think that they will ever accept it, and this same kind of fever swamp will be bubbling throughout his presidency.
Paul Waldman, senior fellow at Media Matters, online at mediamatters.org. Check out the audio and the video and for yourself what is happening on the right-wing channels. You don't have to watch it. You got Media Matters for that. The Southern Poverty Law Center details hundreds of incidents since the election where there have been hate crimes that are focused around Barack Obama. The president-elect has received more death threats than any president-elect prior to him. Is there a correlation between the hate speech we are finding on right-wing radio and the safety and security of our president-elect?
I think without putting explicit blame on any particular individual, I think you have to say yes. It creates that kind of environment. You know, a couple of months ago when that guy went into a Unitarian church and shot up a bunch of the parishioners, and the police went to his house and they found books by people like Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity and Michael Savage in his house, I, for one, was not surprised at all because for people who are unbalanced and who have so much hate in their heart that they're willing to strike out and hurt other people, even kill other people, this kind of rhetoric just feeds right into that. Because one of the themes of all of that rhetoric that you hear on the right is that liberals are destroying America.
Oh yeah.
And if you look at those books that the right wing talk show hosts put out, every one of them has a subtitle that's something like "How Liberals Are Destroying America."
I think that was a subtitle specific of one of Ann Coulter's books.
Yeah, and Michael Savage has a book called "Liberalism Is a Mental Disorder." Again, the idea is that they're your enemies, and they are trying to destroy everything that is right and good about our country, and therefore they must be destroyed.
And bringing it back to the local angle again, Paul Waldman, one of the interesting reports here has been from our local Republican Party on election night. One of our reporters went out here in Madison, Wisconsin, went to the local election party on election night for the Republicans, and found that one person was proclaiming that the Koran would now be the good book in the White House. Another person was handing out a four-page flyer about the parallels between Barack Obama and Adolf Hitler. That this is happening on a very real level in a very local way all over the country, even in the liberal bastion of Madison, Wisconsin. What action do we take, Paul Waldman, to confront this, to deal with it, and make sure our president-elect is safe?
I think the first thing people have to do is understand that it's happening, because so much of it flies under the radar, and the people who listen to this stuff know that it's there, but everybody else, even in a community where it's happening, aren't aware of it. So people should start this discussion really begin to engage their neighbors in a discussion about what is actually going out over their airwaves, and they can call those radio stations and register their complaints. You know, local radio stations are highly attuned to what people in their community are saying about them, and let them know that that kind of stuff is not the sort of thing that they want in their community. It doesn't mean that you're going to get, you know, these hosts pulled off the air in a day and a half, but I think people have to feel like they can talk back to their media. We believe that very strongly at Media Matters. We always put contact information for offending parties on our website, and it's something that people have to do all the time because it's a discussion that we all have a stake in.
Well, that's what I love about Media Matters, Paul Waldman. Not only can you get learn from MediaMatters.org, but also you can get active from MediaMatters.org. Find out more online at MediaMatters.org. Our friend Paul Waldman, senior fellow of Media Matters, thank you as always, sir.
My pleasure.
When we continue, we will be taking a look at the threats to Barack Obama, the hate crimes that we have seen since the election. It will scare you. It will chill you to the bone. It will make you wonder about our president-elect safety and security. Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman. You're listening to Air America Radio.
You're listening to guest host Lee Rayburn, filling in for Tom Hartman.
Assassinate Obama was the chant of school children riding a bus in Idaho, cross burnings in Pennsylvania and Jersey, black figures hung from nooses, racial epithets scrawled on homes and cars, all part of what we have seen across this country as the racism has run rampant since Barack Obama has been elected the first African-American president? Mixed race president? It depends on how you see it. If you see somebody with just melanin and think that they're black, well then, yeah, the first black president. But the problem is, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, there have been literally hundreds of incidents of hate crime since the election already. And it is taking place in places like North Carolina, where NC State had students writing anti-Obama comments in a public place, where one said, "Let's shoot that N-word in the head." But of course, they don't say N-word where they're from. They use the entire derogatory term. Obama has received more threats on his safety than any other president-elect in history. In fact, he alluded to it last night in a strange way on 60 Minutes, and I thought it was worth hearing again, not in the context of the lighthearted fluff piece that Steve Croft did for 60 Minutes, but rather in the context of the fact that the Southern Poverty Law Center has expressed open concern about the hundreds of incidents of hate crime since the election, this election that was, we had hoped, going to lift us above the racism that has run rampant in this nation, and yet, and in the context of Obama receiving more threats than any other president-elect, speaking last night about how his lifestyle has changed since becoming the next president of the United States.
I can't go to my old barbershop now. I've got to have my barber come to some undisclosed location to cut my hair. You know, the small routines of life that keep you connected, I think, some of those are being lost. One of the challenges I think that we're going to be wrestling with is how to stay pretty normal.
That might not be easy if you have every skinhead aiming for you. And it might have sounded like giggle-worthy as you heard Michelle Obama sort of chuckle about Barack's barber. However, it's scary when you consider in Standish, Maine, a sign inside the general store in Standish reads, "Osama Obama Shotgun Pool," and customers were given the opportunity to bet a buck on the date when Obama would be killed. At the bottom of the sign was written, "Hey, let's hope someone wins." This is your president of the United States. This is the next leader of the free world. This is what got the entire world excited again about the United States. This is what made me proud to be an American again. And yet you've got third grade students on a school bus in Idaho chanting "Assassinate Obama." I wonder where they learned that one. Probably not from No Child Left Behind, more likely from Mommy and Daddy. University of Alabama professor had an Obama poster on her office door. It was ripped off, so she replaced it, and this time it was defaced with a death threat and a racial slur. Her response, according to the Associated Press, "Hey, this has brought the racists out of the woodwork, and the truth is, it's true. Crosses have now been burned in yards of Obama supporters in Hardwick, New Jersey, and Apalachin Township, Pennsylvania." The stories go on, and there are literally hundreds of them. But in the context of what this means, let's not forget, 95% of black voters showed up to the polls last 2 weeks ago. Obama won the white vote in 16 states. This isn't just a black president. This is an American president, our president. And maybe Obama's victory was best noted in the Hispanic vote, in places where President Bush had won previously, like New Mexico and Florida. Obama won a bigger share of white voters than John Kerry did in 2004 outside of the South. However, in several southern states like Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas, and Tennessee, Obama did not win as many white voters as John Kerry did 4 years ago. Is this racism? Oh, you bet. Even though more than 60% of Obama's votes came from white voters. Obama talking about being the first black president and how he understood how important it was to this nation, and he understood it through the reaction on election night of his mother-in-law.
You think about Michelle's mom, you know, who grew up on the west and south sides of Chicago, who worked so hard to help Michelle get to where she is, her brother to be successful. She was sitting next to me, actually, as we were watching Returns, mm-hmm. and she's like my grandmother was, sort of a no-fuss type of person.
Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
This is guest host Lee Rayburn, filling in on the Tom Hartman program.
Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman today on the Tom Hartman Show. Happy to have you along for the ride. I wanted to play, before the break, we were playing a clip of the first black president and what it means to Barack Obama as he spoke about it so eloquently last night with Steve Croft on 60 Minutes. I want to play that full clip for you again as we use it as a stark contrast to the hate mongering going on white right-wing radio across the country, as well as the threats, the hate crimes that are going on, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, by the hundreds since the election, according to the threats that have been levied against the president, the most threats of a president-elect, according to authorities. So what does this mean to Barack Obama being the first black president or mixed-race president, depending on how you look at it? Because of the way, the reaction, the ire, and the hatred that it is has raised, the fear, and one person on local right-wing radio from Media Matters saying that Barack Obama was indeed the Antichrist, 666 himself. Really? Certainly didn't sound like it to me last night on 60 Minutes.
You think about Michelle's mom, you know, who grew up on the west and south sides of Chicago, who worked so hard to help Michelle get to where she is, her brother to be successful. She was sitting next to me actually as we were watching Returns, mm-hmm. and she's like my grandmother was, sort of a no fuss type of person. And suddenly she just kind of reached out and she started holding my hand, you know, and kind of squeezing it. And you had this sense of, well, what's she thinking for a black woman who grew up in the 50s in a segregated Chicago to watch her daughter become First Lady of the United States? I think there was that sense across the country, and not unique to African American.
I think that makes the point that this is an opportunity for us to rise above the fray, to be greater than our petty bickerings, to create an opportunity for a future in this country where everybody does have equal opportunity. It makes complete sense to me. Also, last night in the 60 Minutes interview, Barack Obama addressed the issue with the Big Three, the three major American automobile manufacturers, and what is to be done with them. There is a call now to help bail them out. Remember the good old days when we only bailed out Amtrak? And then there were the good old days where we subsidized Amtrak and then we bailed out the airlines. They needed it. It was a post-9/11 world. You got to get in that mindset. And I remember the good old days when we were only bailing out Amtrak, the airlines, and Wall Street. And now, when it comes time to bail out the Big Three, well, there is some consternation about whether, if, and how it is to be done. Barack Obama in 60 Minutes last night talking about the possibility of a bailout of our automobile manufacturers.
My hope is that over the course of the next week, between the White House and Congress, the discussions are shaped around providing assistance, but making sure that that assistance is conditioned on labor, management, suppliers, lenders, all the stakeholders coming together with a plan. What does a sustainable U.S. auto industry look like so that we are creating a bridge loan to somewhere as opposed to a bridge loan to nowhere? And that's, I think, what you haven't yet seen. That's something that I think we're going to have to come up with.
It was Senator Richard Shelby from Alabama, Republican from Alabama, that made the rounds on the Talking Head shows yesterday to speak out against a bailout of the Big Three. See if this makes sense to you.
First of all, I think that we would have to see conditions that would fundamentally change the way Detroit does business. They're not building the right products. They did at one time. They've got good workers, but I don't believe they've got good management. They don't innovate. They're a dinosaur in a sense, and I hate to see this because I would like to see them become lean and hungry and innovative. And if they did and put out the right product, they could survive. But I don't believe the $25 billion they're talking about will make them survive. It's just postponing the inevitable.
Well, that's interesting because the inevitable at this point could mean as many as 2.5 million jobs lost. It's interesting in the economic terms of the day that we are hearing where our stock market is about on the level today, plus or minus. It's jumping right around the zero point of the Dow Jones Industrials. However, Citibank last week reported job cuts of about 20,000. Today they are reporting job cuts that could total as many as 73,000, meaning a 20% reduction in their workforce, 73 jobs gone in the softest labor market in over a generation. And it threatens to get worse. General Motors ended the third quarter with about $16 billion on hand. It needs $11 billion to $14 billion to continue normal operations. They could be out of cash by February and forced to shut down. If, according to the Center for Automotive Research, if just half of the big three auto manufacturing companies in the United States, just half of them were shuttered, 2.5 million jobs would be lost. A quarter of a million of those jobs would be lost directly from the automakers. 800,000 would be lost from suppliers and dealerships. Another 1.5 million jobs lost would be at businesses relying on automaker spending. advertising budgets for things like radio will go out the window. And you're telling me that we're not going to bail them out after we bail out Wall Street? Sure, they're dinosaurs, but wasn't Wall Street? Sure, they're dinosaurs, but wasn't Amtrak? Sure, they're dinosaurs, was it American Airlines? I think it was probably put best yesterday by Tom Friedman from the New York Times, author, economist, smart guy on Meet the Press yesterday, detailing how bailing out auto manufacturers is really another way of saying bailing out the American economy and American workers.
And people say, wait a minute, that's unfair. Banks who are irresponsible are going to get bailed out. That's true. Homeowners who shouldn't have taken out mortgages were irresponsible are going to get bailed out, along with people who worked hard and paid their mortgage. But they say that's unfair. I tell you, Tom, fairness is not on the table anymore. There's only two things on the table: systemic risk, in which we all get wiped out, or we find a way out of this.
How big is the problem? Senator Carl Levin yesterday, Democrat from Michigan, laying it out.
Without any question, we've got at least 3 million jobs dependent upon this industry surviving. We've got, this is a Main Street problem. We've got 10,000 or more dealers. They cover the country and every town of this country. The auto industry touches millions and millions of lives. 1 out of 10 jobs in this country are auto-related. 20% of our retail sales are auto-related or automobiles. So this is a national problem.
We have a GM plant in my backyard. I'm broadcasting from the Air America affiliate in Madison, Wisconsin, the Mike 92.1 today. We have an auto GM plant in Janesville just south of us here, which is going to shut down before the holidays. Just a perfect time to put everybody out on their ass. And not only that, but what we are also seeing with the closing of that GM plant is also the closing of the parts manufacturers. We are seeing a closing of the auto dealerships. We are seeing a ripple effect that sees, and we've seen this before, that the struggles of auto manufacturers are actually trickling down to Main Street as we speak. Carl Levin again speaking yesterday.
$200 billion in lost taxes is the estimate if the domestic automobile industry goes under. $200 billion lost to the taxpayers of America through the loss of these 3 million jobs, the pickup of all the pensions which would be necessary.
So what's on the table? Three options, basically. The first option is to do nothing and let the auto manufacturers die, to put 2.5 million people who rely on the auto industry in the U.S. out on their keister for no other good reason than we're done bailing out industries, we're done privatizing profits while socializing losses, and here's where we draw the line. We draw the line right when 2.5 million people are put out of work. The other option is to take some of that $840 billion of the Wall Street bailout, take $25 million of that, and use it to as a cash infusion, as a loan for the big three. And this is being promoted by Senator President-elect Obama and the likes of Senator Carl Levin from Michigan. This is even being promoted by a couple of Republicans. I think Kit Bond from Missouri is one of them. And who's the other guy that is on board here? I know this one. George Voinovich of Ohio, two Republicans who have backed this plan. It sounds like because he is in political purgatory as we speak, even Republican Senator Norm Coleman, Republican from Minnesota, is on board with that plan. The third option is the option being proffered right now by the Bush White House. They have a plan, and it is to take a previously set aside $25 billion in corporate subsidies for our big auto manufacturers. Now, this $25 billion was supposed to go directly for creating alternative fuel and fuel efficiency standards, which would save the planet. And $25 billion in loans, which had already been approved to develop fuel efficiency standards for the big three. The Bush administration is now saying that they want to use that $25 million not for fuel efficiency standards, but continuing to perpetuate the dinosaur itself. Of course, the likes of our president-elect and Senator Carl Levin and even Republican senators are saying that is at best short-sighted and at worst only putting gauze on a gunshot wound that will sooner or later bleed us dry. So three options on the table. Do nothing. Take a bit, a peck, a smidgen from the $840 billion Wall Street bailout, which has already been passed, and put it into the auto manufacturers' pockets to get them through the holidays, or to take their fuel efficiency money and scrap fuel efficiency altogether and have them continue to build SUVs until they can build them no more. Which plan makes most sense to you, especially figuring 2.5 million jobs are on the line. I only see one solution, as does Tom Friedman from the New York Times, as does President-elect Obama. What's the problem with Republicans? Is this where they draw the line, right before 2.5 million people are thrown out of work? Not good timing. Not good policy either. Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman today. You're listening to Air America Radio.
You're listening to Lee Rayburn, filling in on the Tom Hartman program.
Minutes after the hour. My name is Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Tom Hartman today. Thanks for being along for the ride. Detailing the bailout of the big three. Will the three U.S. auto manufacturers get a cash infusion from the federal government? Three plans on the table. One, do nothing and let them die on the vine, which would cost an estimated 2.5 million jobs. Number two, use money set aside for fuel efficiency standards and development and spend that as just a cash infusion. And number three, take some of a Scotia of the $840 billion bailout plan. Right now, CNBC reports that our bailout total is $4.2 trillion? Man, that's more expensive than two ongoing unnecessary wars. Jeez! So those are the options on the table, and it's interesting because GM could run out of cash over Christmas. And GM is reportedly losing $1 billion, that's a billion with a B, dollars a month. What's the real problem here? They're an auto manufacturer. Our American auto manufacturers, GM, Chrysler, Ford, are at a competitive disadvantage with the rest of the world. Because the rest of the world makes autos in developed nations, and every developed nation but ours has health care. The estimated increased cost that is incurred with a single General Motors vehicle that goes towards retirees and employees' health care, $1,500 per vehicle. $1,500 per the price tag of each car goes into health care. It's not airbags. It's not security. Heck, it's not even your satellite radio. It's to go to health care. Well, why can't we be competitive with Toyota or Honda or some of the foreign auto manufacturers? Well, because they have a $1,500 advantage with every vehicle that they sell, because their developed nations are developed enough to understand that the largest insurance pool is the best insurance pool, and the largest insurance pool is the entire nation with a single-payer healthcare system, which nobody is talking about right now, and yet should be mentioned. Because if we wanted a competitive to put GM on a level playing field with the rest of the world in terms of competing, well, for starters, we want them to be able to save $1,500 from every automobile by making sure that they are not paying for their health care coverage for their employees with the sale of every automobile. It has put them at a complete disadvantage, so much so that General Motors stock is now below its 1946 price. I think Linens and Things stock is doing better than GM right now, or was it Bed Bath & Beyond? I forget. And even one investment house, according to the Boston Herald today, has priced the GM stock at zero. Well, that sounds like a bargain. Heck, I'll get some zero stock. That stock I can afford. So it'll be interesting to see how the debate develops. Dana Perino, the White House spokesperson, said, you know what, the Democrats' path is a partisan path that'll only lead to partisan rancor. Really? Because the way I see it, the only path that we have for a future for our automobile industries is continue to allow them to develop fuel efficiency standards. And yeah, they're late in the game. But another big problem that must be dealt with is that $1,500 that goes into the cost of every automobile that they sell that goes to health care. And we cannot solve that problem without dealing with the issue of health care for all in this country. That must be priority number one. A couple of other notes, and here was T. Boone Pickens yesterday on Meet the Press detailing what he thought about what we should do with our auto industry. Of course, he did not talk about his privatization of water plans. This was more about his natural gas plans.
Well, here we have an abundant, cleaner by 80% than diesel, cheaper, and it's ours. We need to put our heavy-duty 18-wheelers on the natural gas.
The GOP plan? Drill, baby, drill. That ought to do us some good. Sure, it'll help us fill up the gas tank, but what if nobody's making gas tanks in the United States anymore? Under a quiet proposal late on election day, oh, wow, no wonder we didn't hear about it. The U.S. Bureau of Land Management announced that there will be an auction next month of more than 50,000 acres of oil and gas parcels alongside or within view of the beautiful Arches National Park, as well as two other national parks in Utah, Dinosaur National Park and Canyonlands. Interesting, because the National Park Service's top official had no idea this was going to happen. You know, the arch that's on the, it is on the Utah license plate, right? I seem to remember at least it was when I was driving through Utah. Well, that arch may now be, well, it may have a, well, an oil drill in the middle of it. The National Park Service top official called it shocking and disturbing, says his agency was never notified of this sale. The chief Park Service administrator in Utah is Cordell Roy, and here's what he had to say. Hey, you know what? They added 51,000 acres of tracks near Arches, Dinosaur, and Canyonlands without telling us a damn thing. Pardon me. That's 40 tracks within 4 miles of these national parks. A compromise would require the land developer to take quite seriously the Park Service's objection. But there's nothing in the so-called compromise that would protect Arches National Park. While we're dealing with an automobile crisis, the Bush administration has decided that they'll drill in national parks as an outgoing statement of their commitment to more oil and more of the dinosaurs that we have seen Senator Richard Shelby talk about. Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman. You're listening to Air America Radio.
This is Lee Rayburn, guest hosting on the Tom Hartman Program.
Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman today, and I'm just going over my ballot. How about yours? Have you checked it out yet? Joining us this afternoon, senior researcher for the Center for Media and Democracy, online at prwatch.org, Diane Farsetta joining us. Good afternoon, Diane.
Hi, how are you, Lee?
Well, I was just filling out my big ballot.
That's right. The voting just doesn't stop this year.
Well, it is that time of year. Award season has come again, and one of my favorite awards, this time the fifth annual Falsy Awards, put together by our Center for Media and Democracy. The falsies are the worst of the worst, aren't they?
That's right, that's right. We say, we've been joking this year that it's actually the time when you want to vote for the worst candidate on the ballot.
Oh, good. Vote your fears at prwatch.org. And you've got a list of the nominees up, and I've just been going over them, and I got to tell you, there is no lack of possible nominees for falsies this year.
It is. It's really pretty remarkable. And, you know, we tend to, you know, sort of, as we're sort of slogging through, you know, week after week, month after month, you know, we always have more to work on than we have time to work on it. But it always does give you pause when we get to the end of the year and we say, okay, well, what are the worst things that have happened in PR and in media deception over the past year? And, wow, it is a long list this year. I mean, I do think it's worse than usual even.
Where do you even want to start with this, Diane? Because the list is, it runs the gamut of all the political arguments. Let's start with Iraq and the military. And what we saw or heard about earlier this year, I think many of us could have figured on our own that more than 75 retired military officers who served as media commentators were actually taking part in a Pentagon pundit program, receiving special briefings, access to information, and also some free trips.
Right, right. Yeah, this is a huge issue, and it's one that I really take any opportunity to raise, because it is. It was a massive propaganda program that started in early 2002 to sell the Iraq War. The Pentagon, actually a former PR person who was at the time working in the Pentagon, started up the program. It was far-reaching. It was really nefarious. There was no accountability for it, no disclosure of many of these retired military officers who were pundits. Many of them also were lobbyists or contractors for defense companies, military companies on the side. So multiple levels of conflicts of interest there. But yeah, they were going out, they were selling us not only on the Iraq War, but on Guantanamo Bay, on the military presence in Afghanistan. So a lot was going on there, and still no one's been held accountable for
that.
But
they weren't doing it because it was good for the country. At least it's hard to figure that now that we know what they were doing was actually good for them.
Right. It was, oh yeah, it was very good for them. And actually some of the most chilling information that's come out about the program is a number of people, a number of the pundits that were involved actually were getting briefed on the Iraq War and how it was going so well and were repeating these Pentagon talking points to the media, sort of, you know, ignoring their own doubts and not voicing their own doubts because they were afraid they might lose contracts with the Pentagon if they did so. Mm. So, I mean, this is really serious stuff. You know, it's the falsies overall is pretty funny, but this is something that, you know, really, I think it's an opportunity maybe with a change of the guard there in the White House to really push for the need for accountability on this.
Well, and let's give Barack Obama an elbow to the ribs, shall we? This idea
so.
Of clean coal that has come up in the presidential election. Really? Coal can be clean? It's new
right.
to me.
Right, right, yes, right, exactly. And one of our many falsies nominees is a coal industry front group called Americans for Balanced Energy Choices. And basically, if you've been watching TV at all over the past year, you've probably seen some of their ads.
Yeah, they're very balanced for coal.
They're exactly. It's, you know, it's a strange sort of balance, but, you know, it's so, yeah, I mean, these are there, and there are other coal industry front groups that go by such other lovely names as Americans for Americans Power, you know, all these sorts of nice things that they're really trying to say, you know, don't worry about the fact that coal is a major contribution to greenhouse gas emissions. We're going to pretend there's such a thing as clean coal and get you to buy into that.
What was the price tag for pretending that there was clean coal?
Well, the Americans for Balanced Energy Choices front group spent $35 million just over the past year on ads talking about clean coal, and that's in addition to millions more that they spent actually co-sponsoring presidential debates, hiring people to walk around outside the debates as quote-unquote human billboards talking about the importance of clean coal. So really, this is something that, as you mentioned, President-elect Obama has bought into and something that environmentalists are really going to have to watchdog his administration on.
Well, and one of the other issues that we'll be watching President-elect Obama as he moves into the White House on is our civil liberties, which have been torn asunder over the last 8 years. And another nominee for the falsies online at prwatch.org with our guest, Ian Farsetta, from the Center for Media and Democracy. Another one of the nominees, the amount of spying that went on in the last year and where we saw that spying. A story that I had detailed on Air America Radio is Max Obuchevsky from the Maryland Anti-Death Penalty Group actually had a Homeland Security Maryland police officer infiltrate the Anti-Death Penalty Group because, you know, they're terrorists.
Right, right.
Where else have we seen that in the last year?
Yeah, there has been an increase in spying on various groups. Nice, you know, environmental groups.
Terrorists!
Gun control groups.
Terrorists!
You know, these are groups that, you know, I think most of your listeners, if they haven't taken part in directly, you know, they certainly are familiar with and are very comfortable with. But, you know, in the case, in our falsies nominee, we're not talking about the government and police spies as much. We're talking about corporate spies. And unfortunately, there's a long and sordid history of corporations spying on activist groups. And we saw this last year, the union, the wonderful, labor union group, Coalition of Immokalee Workers, that's really, fought for the rights of tomato pickers.
Yeah, that powerful union.
That's right, that's right. So, you know, they had Burger King actually hired spies to go and to infiltrate some of their planning, their strategy calls.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, Burger King was really horrible on this. You know, this is something that Taco Bell said, yes, we'll pay a penny more. McDonald's said, yes, we'll pay a penny more for our tomatoes so that tomato pickers can get a little bit more than slavery wages. And Burger King
did come around on that, if I'm not mistaken, right?
After they were outed for spying on them, after they were outed on engaging in a you know, online smear campaign.
Shamed
against
into
them.
Paying their tomato
exactly.
pickers a couple pennies more?
Exactly.
Oh
yep.
This is too good.
They took the hard way.
Yeah, by spying on the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. I can't believe that. Let's go to Senator Hillary Clinton's chief campaign strategist, Mark Penn, the man who did not know know how the Democratic primary worked and may have cost Senator Clinton at least some primary votes or in the process. Mark Penn's on the list as a nominee for the fifth annual False Lease from the Center for Media and Democracy. Why?
Right, and it's thinking back a while to think about Hillary Clinton and Mark Penn. But Mark Penn, you know, he does much more than run campaigns into the ground. He actually also runs the one of the most major PR firms in the country, Burson Marsteller, and actually around the world. He's the worldwide CEO. He also has his own polling company. So he is deep in with a lot of corporate clients as well as political clients. He actually, on an internal Burson Marsteller blog, he talked about how working for the Clinton campaign, the presidential campaign, was very good for business, you know, in that it would get him in with a lot of, you know, high players.
Wow.
But basically, he got into trouble, and he was eventually supposedly demoted by the campaign, even though he hung around for a while afterwards. When he met with Colombian government leaders, his firm, Burson Marsteller, was promoting the Colombia Free Trade Agreement, which candidate Hillary Clinton very strongly opposed. When it came out that he had met with these government officials to promote the trade agreement, you know, Clinton said, oh, this is horrible. You know, we have to demote him. As I said, he lingered on for a while at the campaign, even after he was supposedly gone. But, you know, it was sort of funny because his damage control was to say, oh, it was horrible of me to meet with the Colombian officials. Then that got Colombia actually upset. And then so he couldn't win anywhere he turned. But he lost a good, actually, $300,000 a year contract that Colombia had with the Burson Marsteller firm. Was then they pulled that out of being upset at his remarks.
It's fascinating to me, Diane, for a set of how much PR we ingest every day without even knowing it. And we didn't know, we could have assumed, but we didn't know that the war was being sold to us as a PR campaign. But heck, even the Summer Olympics this year were sold to us as a PR campaign.
Right. And this is a really interesting year for looking at PR around the Olympics. You're going to China, obviously a country that has major human rights concerns, but wanted to present itself, wanted to use the Olympics to present itself as a wonderful modern society, at the same time that human rights activists were saying, hey, this is a platform for us to raise our issues, mm-hmm. whether it be Darfur or whether it be the situation in Tibet or, you know, just general democracy activists in China that are unfortunately often jailed. So, you know, you had, as there were overwhelmingly nonviolent protests led by Tibetan monks in China. You had China limiting media coverage, you know, sort of independent international media coverage of the events, using not representative video footage of the protest to say, actually, these are violent and these are racist things.
But Diane, they didn't even use actual video footage of the opening ceremony.
That's right. There was, it was such spin. It's true. You know,
they didn't even use the actual young Chinese girl singer because she wasn't pretty enough for the TV.
That's right.
The whole thing was a sham.
The whole thing was a sham. It was just sort of the total, example of image over substance over anything. So that's China Goes for the Gold falsely is one of our nominees.
I am inclined to give that the gold award. Now, when you go to PRWatch.org, you can give it a gold award, a silver award, a bronze award, or dishonorable mention. You need to get it in before the 1st of December because we will know the winners by the end of the year. And you know what? The clean coal wasn't the only energy angle in the PR movement in 2008, as recognized by the falsies nominees, Diane Farsetta. Also, Chevron shows up on your list. Why?
Right. And this is really remarkable as well. You know, Chevron, this major oil company, one of the largest in the world, throughout 2008 decided that it was going to play the helpless victim. You know, and this is in response
poor
to
oil companies.
Poor little Chevron. You know, they're so put upon. But, you know, there were two particular sort of challenges to Chevron that made them try to play the victim. And one was that there are two legal activists from Ecuador that are pursuing an environmental liability case against Chevron for some very serious sort of, you know, pollution in Ecuador. Those Ecuadorians actually won one of the most prestigious environmental prizes, the Goldman Environmental Prize, in April. So Chevron said, you know, what's going on in Ecuador is just we're being made the victim of a shakedown. They just want to try and take money from us, even though it's not our responsibility.
It's a shakedown now.
It's a shakedown, yeah.
When oil companies go into sovereign nations and loot and pillage before they leave.
That's right.
Now it's a shakedown.
That's right, exactly. And then the other thing that happened is that there are, and this is an ongoing court case brought by Nigerian villagers in a very serious attack on, again, a nonviolent protest, where Chevron personnel, all evidence points to their involvement in an attack on a protest where
what?
Some of the protesters were killed.
What?
And this goes back to the 80s, but, you know, they're still pursuing the justice in the court system. So, again, Chevron's saying, you know, no, what really happened, we're the victim here. And what really happened is that villagers took Chevron workers hostage and then attacked the law enforcement, the Nigerian police, which, you know, again, not a great human rights record there, you know, when they arrived on the scene.
Diane Farsetta, are there any things that did not make the list of nominees for the fifth annual Falsies from the Center for Media and Democracy that we should keep in mind? You know, one of the things I think about is the treatment of Amy Goodman at the Republican National Convention. And there wasn't really a PR spin there. It was just that for some reason the national media decided not to cover the police presence at the national conventions this year.
Right. I mean, that's a great observation, and definitely, and not just Amy Goodman, but a number of journalists, yep. You know, along with nonviolent protesters, and unfortunately,
I think
that's
Food
what
Not Bombs
see.
Was raided before the convention because they were all afraid that there would be Food Not Bombs at the Republican National Convention.
That's right. I don't know if they're anti-ramen or what, but, you know, it's actually, you know, for the Falsies, if there are great ideas like that that we haven't covered, we put out 10 nominees, mm-hmm. but we have a space where people can come in and say, you know, these are the people that aren't on your list that should be, and to give just those examples. And we
there
do have
are
a,
hundreds.
Yeah, exactly.
Diane Farsetta, what a fun way to wrap up our year by pointing out all the PR that we've ingested and didn't even know about.
That's
I've got
right.
heartburn just thinking about it. It's a pleasure to speak with you, Diane.
Yeah,
thank you,
too.
As always. Diane Farsetta, senior researcher for the Center for Media and Democracy, right here in my backyard of Madison, Wisconsin. Proud to have him. Vote for your fifth annual Falsie Award winners at PRWatch.org. The results will be coming up in December, and hopefully we'll have a chance to bring them to you. My name is Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Tom Hartman today. We will continue up next. The hidden health hazard of wind farms. Really? This is Air America Radio.
You're listening to guest host Lee Rayburn, filling in for Tom Hartman.
Well, here's one for the Falsies that may make it into the 2009 Falsie Awards from the Center for Media and Democracy. Taking a look at our energy future, poo-pooing clean coal, which even Barack Obama has supported in his campaign. Taking a look at the bailout of the three big auto manufacturing companies and whether or not that will be dependent, as the White House would like, on spending their money on fuel efficiency rather than just filling their budget shortfall right now. Listen, we have a real environmental disaster going on in California, the likes of which we haven't seen in a couple of generations out there. The fires have calmed today a little bit out west along with the winds. However, it has taken its toll already, and some of the fires have even moved to the OC in Orange County. Governor Schwarzenegger talking yesterday about the fires that have taken place in California.
When you walk around the areas that was devastated, it looked like hell. And I tell you, I feel horrible for the people that have been affected by that, whose homes burned down and losing all their personal belongings.
It's a global warming issue, right? I mean, that's kind of the point. Here's Arnold Schwarzenegger yesterday on, I think this was Meet the Press. It was one of the Sunday Talking Heads.
Through global warming, we have now a fire season all year round. We used to have fire seasons only in the fall, but now the fire seasons start in February already. So this means that we have to really upgrade and have more resources, more fire engines, more manpower, and all of this, which of course does cost extra money.
The Republican governor of California made clear this is a product of global warming. This is what we will see with the extended dry seasons and the lack of rain. And these are the real results as captured by CNN Radio.
It literally just took over. and only 7 years to go on this house, too. And I would have been done. But thank God I have family. That's all that matters, is family.
But, nevertheless, it continues the refutation of renewable energy resources. This from KATU in Oregon. Morrow County, Oregon, has this story about wind turbine syndrome. That's right. Sherry Eaton and her husband Mike live in a 10-acre rural home in Morrow County, Oregon. And down on a ridgeline near their home, they now have about a dozen wind turbines. Full throttle, renewable energy. Doesn't cost much other than the installation of these wind turbines. However, it has created wind turbine syndrome for the Eaton family. That's right. Sure, we've got clean coal, but then you can't use the wind turbines because they'll give you the wind turbine syndrome. Mike Eaton said, my health concern is because I have a motion disorder. It's a product of an injury suffered as a Vietnam veteran, and I certainly wouldn't slight that ever. My father's a Vietnam veteran. However, the speculation now is the Eatons may be filing suit because of what the wind turbines are doing to them and their health. I don't know what the turbines will do to me, said Mike Eaton. I don't want to find out. A New York physician and ecologist, Dr. Nina Pierport, has now published a book detailing the problems associated with wind turbine syndrome, a debilitating complex of symptoms. It includes sleep disturbance, headaches, dizziness, vertigo, nausea. It sounds like the list of possible side effects for every ad for every pharmaceutical on TV right now. But no, this is from wind turbines. They will do it to you. Dr. Pierpont's hypothesis says wind turbines produce vibration, low-frequency noise, and their moving shadows create visual stimulation known as a flicker, and all these things can affect the body negatively. Really? How about coal emissions? How about greenhouse gases? How about the fires we are seeing burning in California where the Republican governor there admits it's a product of our global warming? How about that for a syndrome? Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Tom Hartman today on Air America Radio.
This is guest host Lee Rayburn, filling in on the Tom Hartman program.
Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman today on Air America Radio, broadcasting from the Air America affiliate, the Mike 92.1 in Madison, Wisconsin. Thank you for being a part of our day. Our phones are down today, so we're just going to have to go solo. We do have a guest coming up this hour. The gun guys join us to take a look at the run on guns since Barack Obama's been elected. Really? Is that true? Or is it just one of those stories that the NRA had placed everywhere late last week? It's always interesting to me, these stories that pop up in this different news outlets all at the same time, all instantaneously. It's almost as if they all got the same facts from the same PR firm at the same time. Or maybe my mind's just clouded by having the opportunity to speak with Diane Farsetta about the Falsi Awards, the PR awards of the year from the Center for Media and Democracy in the last hour. Well, Barack Obama is busy in transition, as today he was meeting with Senator John McCain. And interesting, and you have to ask yourself, do you think that John McCain would have invited Barack Obama if the roles were reversed? Pardon me, I don't think so. Barack Obama making small talk about the Bears and the Cardinals today with Senator John McCain.
They brought up the Bears.
Ah.
I tell you what, Arizona's, they've got a real
so if they sat around talking about Kurt Warner versus Kyle Orton all day, I'm not so sure anything good came of it. But actually, Barack Obama said they did have a good conversation this afternoon, Senator McCain and the president-elect.
Just going to have a good conversation about how we can do some work together to fix up the country.
Interesting, seeing as how during the presidential campaign, specifically during one of the presidential debates, it was John McCain that didn't even know the name of the man he was running against, or if he knew it, he wasn't going to say it.
You know who voted for it? Might never know. That one. You know who voted against it? Me.
That one. That one met with John McCain today because that one was gracious in victory. And Senator John McCain certainly looked uncomfortable in defeat from the B-roll footage we saw. Now, this is on the heels of last week. The trial balloon floated about Barack Obama, and Andrea Mitchell from NBC says this is the real deal. And she is inside about as much as anybody. So I would trust her that Secretary of State role is possibly Senator Hillary Clinton's to have. Interesting, going back to the Democratic primary presidential debate of December of last year, when Barack Obama was speaking even then of having Hillary Clinton in his cabinet.
How will you rely on so many Clinton advisors and still deliver the kind of break from the past that you're promising voters?
Well, the, you know, I am...
I want to hear that.
Well, Hillary, I'm looking forward to you advising me as well.
who knew at the time that was much more than just a punchline? Barack Obama last night on 60 Minutes speaking with Steve Croft about his cabinet plans and keeping tight-lipped about it all.
You met with Senator Clinton this week?
I did.
Is she on the short list for a cabinet position?
You know, she is somebody who I needed advice and counsel from. She's one of the most thoughtful public officials that we have. Beyond that, you're not getting anything out of me, Steve.
Will it be Republicans in the cabinet?
Yes.
More than one?
You're not getting more out of me.
There was some interesting parts of the interview last night in 60 Minutes, largely contained to the first 10 minutes. The rest was a lot of fluff. And there are some serious problems at hand, as Barack Obama mentioned last night, that we got a lot to get into.
We've got a lot of problems, a lot of big challenges.
There have been moments when you've said, where did I get myself into?
You know, surprisingly enough, I feel right now that I'm doing what I should be doing. That gives me a certain sense of calm. I will say that the challenges that we're confronting are enormous.
One of those challenges that they are confronting is ending the revolving door between lobbyists and the administration. As we saw the likes of David Safavian in the Bush administration's Office of Management and Budget dragged out in a perp walk with handcuffs because he was selling, as part of the Jack Abramoff K Street scandal, he was selling off the White House to the highest bidder. That's not going to happen under an Obama administration. The New York Times detailed this yesterday, but raised some questions that are worth asking. President-elect Barack Obama has imposed a stricter conflict of interest restriction on his White House transition team than any president prior. This is unprecedented for the president-elect in trying to end that revolving door. However, that has some problems with the staunch, lifelong policymakers on Capitol Hill, as it's awfully difficult to end that revolving door that's been going around and around for so long now. Obama has imposed rules that bar officials on his transition team from handling any issues in areas of policy where they have lobbied over the last 12 months or from seeking to influence the same agencies over the next 12 months. Obama's transition team also is barred from working on matters where family members or recent business associates may have a conflict of interest. In cases where there's even an appearance of conflict, then those transition team members must seek a waiver from the transition's executive director, Christopher Liu. It is unfortunate, then, that even Christopher Liu has some appearances of conflict that must be resolved. Part of the where does progressive radio go from here is not to be I'm not going to be. And first and foremost, let me be honest with you. I'm not a Democrat. I vote for Democratic candidates. It's been a long time since I voted for Republican, and only then was that at the local level. But I'm not a Democrat. I'm an American, first and foremost. I put my country above everything else. Well, I put humanity above everything else, and then country comes next. I'm proud of this country. I love what it is. I loved the opportunity to crisscross it about 10, 12 years ago, back and forth, following my favorite bands across the country. What a way to see such a diverse nation, because no matter where I went, all my friends came with me, so it was quite easy. But there are some issues raised, some red flags that the Times pointed out yesterday in David Kirkpatrick's article. Henry Rivera, former Democratic commissioner on the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, was involved in planning the agency's transition, has now dropped out of that role because he had represented clients on communication policy in the past year, violating Obama's transition team rules, and so forth. He's gone. This was made public on Friday. However, now Henry Rivera is listed on the team handling science, technology, space, and the arts. They just removed him from the FCC work that he was doing because the rules as they are written by Obama's administration transition team allow people who have lobbied in one area to join the Obama transition team in another area, and that's what happened in the case of Henry Rivera. But there are other cases. Keith Harper is detailing the transition inside our Interior Department, lobbied earlier this year for Native American tribes. Overseeing the Consumer Product Safety Commission, Pamela Gilbert, former executive director of the agency who as recently as 2 years ago lobbied for consumer advocacy. Now, that is 2 years ago. However, last year she lobbied for Bar Laboratories and an investor group and for an antitrust enforcement group. Oh, that's cutting it close. And I want to end this revolving door because we've seen the worst of it over the last 8 years, how our legislation was paid for and sent to the highest bidder, how all the corporate welfare programs were doled out to oil companies seeking billions of dollars of tax breaks in an energy plan put together behind closed doors by Vice President Dick Cheney. Sally Katzen is another member of the supervisory group, this 12-member panel overseeing the transition. And she was registered last year to lobby for the pharmaceutical company Amgen on Medicare reimbursements. John White, former Clinton official charged with overseeing the new Defense Department, is a partner in a firm that invests in defense contracts. Michael Warren, overseeing the Treasury transition, is CEO of a firm that lobbies for clients, including the U.S.-India Business Council. There are some issues to be dealt with. And the transition's executive director, as we brought up before, Christopher Liu, who is in charge of policing potential conflicts and doling out waivers when necessary in appearances of conflicts in the Obama transition team. Well, Christopher Liu's wife, Catherine, is a lawyer who represents corporate clients dealing with federal environmental regulations. Christopher's older brother, Curtis, is a top lawyer for Fannie Mae. Huh. For now. Advisors assigned to each agency will have to report back to the 12-person working group in this transition team of the upcoming Obama administration. However, questions continue about whether or not this revolving door will shut. Certainly Obama is trying to shut it. I think that much is evident, and it needs to be closed. However, there are some examples outstanding that need to be dealt with. Although I like the direction he's going, meanwhile, the Republican Party is going in the other direction. What was one of their first acts since the election? To try to repeal one of the bills that was written into law and authored by none other than their presidential candidate, John McCain. 9 days after the election, the Republican National Committee filed suit trying to end McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform. While Barack Obama is trying to end the revolving door between lobbyists and politicians, the Republican National Committee is trying to end the campaign finance reform authored by their presidential candidate, claiming the campaign finance reform for McCain-Feingold is unconstitutional. Why? Well, to Republicans, money equals free speech. Which, if you believe that, I've got some free speech I'd like to sell you. John McCain was the man behind the money ban, as was my senator in Wisconsin, Russ Feingold. Russ Feingold called the lawsuit filed by the RNC last week, quote, disappointing, saying that the party that just nominated John McCain as its standard bearer is again trying to undermine the law he worked so hard to pass. Remember, Senator Feingold was used as an example by John McCain in the presidential debates as one of the examples that John McCain had of reaching over the aisle. Well, the Republican National Committee is now trying to sever that reach. Senator Feingold going on to say, I am confident that this effort will fail because the court will continue to recognize that Congress has the power to prevent prevent very large contributions from corrupting our political process. Well, let's hope so. But while one party is trying to end the revolving door, the other one is trying to open up the spigots once again. What will come? Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman. You're listening to Air America Radio.
You're listening to Lee Rayburn, filling in on the Tom Hartman program.
We brought you in the last hour details the struggle, actually, yeah, the threats facing Barack Obama today and the hate crimes by the hundreds that have come in since the election of Barack Obama. Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman this afternoon on Air America Radio at 21 minutes after the hour. Here's how CNN detailed the story.
Over the country, incidents maligning President-elect Obama are surfacing, crushing the post-election hope of racial progress and harmony, and revealing stubborn racism that remains in America. From coast to coast, police have documented alleged crimes, including vandalism, threats, and at least one physical attack. Insults and taunts have been uttered by adults, college students, and even elementary school children.
The Southern Poverty Law Center has detailed literally hundreds of hate crimes already since the election that have something to do with President-elect Barack Obama. I thought that story was scary in context with the other reactions that we're seeing to the president-elect. And let's just go through some of the headlines as has been put together by Jack Schaefer at Slate.com. Thank you, Jack, for doing this. Gun sales thriving in uncertain times, the Washington Post article headline. Election triggers upsurge in military-like firearm sales, the Salt Lake Tribune detailed that. New York Times headline. On concerns over gun control, gun sales are up. The Associated Press headline. Fears of Democrat crackdown lead to gun sales boom. Reuters headline. Obama win triggers run on guns in many stores. Kansas City Star headline. Elections outcome triggers record sales at gun shops. Anchorage Daily News headline. Armed and nervous in Alaska. Fox News headline. Gun owners stockpiling over fear of Democratic weapons ban. CNN.com's headline, gun sales surge after Obama election. The Chicago Tribune headline, Obama win triggers run on guns. I'm getting tired now. Globe and Mail headline, Obama win spurs U.S. gun sales boom. The question that Jack Schaefer at Slate.com asked is, really? Seriously? Is that true? Federal law requires licensed gun dealers to submit background check requests of all purchasers through the FBI's National Instant Criminal Background Check System. However, when you look at the statistics, it's not quite clear whether or not that's borne out. Anecdotally speaking, I had a friend of mine who told me that her husband, without her knowing, went out to a gun sale the other day and got a gun. And when asked, honey, why would you go get a gun? We got Christmas coming. We've got holiday shopping for the kids. Times are tight and money's tighter. What the hell are you doing going out? And what was his standard boilerplate answer? Gonna take our guns away! Barack Obama's going to take away the guns. First of all, no. And second of all, what do you need an assault rifle for anyway? Are you really going to be assaulting that buffalo? Deer? Pheasant? What else do they hunt these days? Well, in my home state of Wisconsin, they hunt doves. You're going to hunt doves with an assault rifle? Go get them, Tiger. Show them you're a man. Compensate for your... Never mind. It's like a red sports car to me. It's just an extension of what they are lacking. So with the details of the federal background check from the FBI, the Washington Post, who originally had this story in at the end of October, even before the election, reports that there were 8.4 million background checks from January 1st to September 28th, compared with 7.5 million in the same period last year. It's a 9% increase. But the first full year of background checks wasn't until 1999. We didn't even have background checks during the Clinton administration. Remember when Bill Clinton took away all our guns? We had to fend for ourselves with sticks and stones? God, those were some scary times. Economically, they were wonderful, and our foreign policy was very peaceful, but he took away our... Oh, wait. No, he didn't. And there's no indication that Barack Obama's going to take away your guns either, unless, of course, you want an assault rifle to kill that pheasant. In that case, then you've got more problems than we can deal with legislation. If these background checks only go back to 1999, we don't know really what a change of the administration means to background checks. Well, I mean, 8.6 million background checks were conducted in the first year. Compare that with 8.4 million background checks this year so far. Well, if that's the facts, then the headlines should actually read, less people go out to get guns under Obama administration than under incoming Bush administration. That would be a headline worth reading. But that's not the way all these newspapers couch the story. And the story may not be a story at all. Coming up next, the Gun Guys join us from gunguys.com. And they'll tell us the scoop. I research what they have on guns every day. But if they had 8.6 million background checks when George W. took office and 8.4 million background checks when Barack Obama took office, then is there really a surge in guns right now because of Barack Obama? Or could somebody say that there were was a bigger surge back when George W. got into office because, you know, he was going to take away our guns? Get bent. Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman today. The Gun Guys join us next. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Air America Radio.
This is Lee Rayburn, guest hosting on the Tom Hartman Program.
Four minutes after the hour, my name is Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Tom Hartman today. Happy to be along on Air America Radio. Joining us this afternoon from Chicago, from the Gun Guys, online at gunguys.com. He's the communications director for the Freedom State Alliance, Scott Vogel. Good afternoon, Scott.
Thank you so much for having us, Lee. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's a pleasure to speak with you again, and I use gunguys.com all the time to keep up to date on how they're trying to take my guns away. We just detailed the slew of stories that seemed to come out at one time within a period of literally 3 days. Just about every national or every local regional newspaper ran a story about how the election of President Barack Obama has led to a run on guns. Really?
Yeah, it's interesting what's happened right now is because what I think has happened is that the gun industry used the election of Senator Obama as the president-elect of the United States to say to their customer base, why don't you go grab another gun? Go buy another assault rifle because you just might get them taken away. And what you basically had a story happened about, we first noticed about 2 weeks before the election, and sure enough, one paper after another started running these stories. And it was, in many ways, in a very cynical sense, the perfect public relations strategy from the gun lobby and the gun industry. Every local TV reporter, every local newspaper could go down to their local gun dealer and ask them, have more people come to buy guns? There's no verification whether that many people have or have not, but they said, yeah, of course, a lot of people are buying guns. And suddenly this story was sort of, it spread like wildfire. Now, having said that, it's possible that there may be an uptick in gun sales, but the critical thing to understand is from our analysis, there are people who already own guns. And they probably own several. So they're probably, what looks like to us, is people buying their fourth or seventh or ninth gun that they already have. And so I think the gun industry has used the election of Barack Obama to its advantage, to resell their market. And that's exactly what this is. We saw these same fears after Y2K, that there was a surge of gun sales. It didn't happen. After September 11th attacks, we were told that there was a massive and dramatic surge of gun sales. Didn't happen. People said that after Hurricane Katrina and this fear, this paranoia that law enforcement officers were rounding up guns in New Orleans. Didn't happen. So, you know, it's possible
what
that...
What did happen then?
I think what you've seen is that the gun industry has saturated their market and they constantly need something to sell more product. And fear... And, you know, driving fear sells in the same way that some industries use sex to sell. I think the gun industry uses fear.
Well, and I think that has become obvious with each and every time that the American people are scared. What's the news story we hear? Get your guns. Get your guns. But that doesn't happen. Didn't happen after 9/11. If it didn't happen after 9/11, would it ever? And you detailed as the story that if we're looking at background checks, we may be seeing gun owners actually just upping their arsenal a little, as opposed to people who aren't handgun owners going out and getting their first assault rifle just to see what it feels like.
Yeah, I think there's some troubling signs on the horizon. As you heard, I heard you talking about the report from the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Yeah, you've got that at gunguys.com right now.
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, basically what they're reporting is that there has been a dramatic surge, as it were, of threats. Threats of violence, racist graffiti, burning crosses in people's...
Hate crimes,
just essentially.
Just hate crimes.
And so what we're worried about, of course, is that nexus between radical and right-wing fringe groups and weapons and guns. And there's certainly a correlation between the two. Now, not to say that just because you're a gun owner that you're a racist or anything like that, but there are extreme organizations and individuals who are very well armed.
We've heard from the Center for Media and Democracy in this show about the PR spin that goes on, and you've alluded to it with the gun industry using Barack Obama as a PR chip. We have heard from Media Matters about the right-wing hate that is going on and the fear that is being stoked, not just from national right-wing talk show hosts on the radio, but local talk show hosts from coast to coast in right-wing radio. But at the same time, the facts just don't bear out that we are arming ourselves to the teats here in preparation of an Obama administration. The National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago found that gun ownership in the U.S. has actually been falling consistently in the last 30 years.
Yeah, and quite dramatically at that. I think it's interesting, too, to put this in context. You know, back in 1993 and 94, the Clinton administration passed the Brady Bill in 93, and then in 94 passed the assault weapon ban. Now, part of the reason for that was there was significant levels of crime and homicide, gun homicides happening. Some of those numbers have dropped somewhat now, about a decade later. But what's interesting is, you know, the next year, in 1995, of course, there was Oklahoma City. And I think that you have to understand that when you pollute the airwaves with, you know, sometimes covert or sometimes direct hate speech, essentially, and use sometimes coded words and sometimes even more direct than that, that certain groups of people are not to be trusted, they're not patriots, they should be taken away from the United States, whether they're immigrants, whether they're Democrats, whether they're African Americans.
Scott, we had one right-wing talk show host that we played on the first hour of the Tom Hartman Show here today, where he was saying unequivocally that Barack Obama, he's not a Muslim, he's not a foreigner, he's the Antichrist.
That's what I mean. Right, and there's a certain, it's toxic is what it is. There's no other way to say it. It's pollution. And most people can discern it, dismiss it, don't listen to it, but there's a few people who absorb it. Mm-hmm. And that pollution, that toxicity can corrode a person's mind. And I think it's very troubling to us, because the truth of the matter is, you know, we see gun violence and violence in general not in political terms. We understand, we're smart enough to understand that it gets filtered through a political prism. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, violence doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether you're young or old. Democrat, Republican, Independent, you know, there are untold numbers of people who are injured and killed by guns and other forms of violence that we just need to address through a systemic, comprehensive, thoughtful way. I think that's why there's a lot of hope about Senator Obama, is that he is a person, so it appears, who will govern from a common sense, evidence-based approach, which I think gives a certain amount of hope to advocates that he will enact policies to reduce violence. Now, those policies, to a certain paranoid and fringe group, may upset them. I mean, I think that there's a certain worry of now, that doesn't mean Senator Obama or President-elect Obama shouldn't take action and move strongly and swiftly.
On Obama's own website, he says that the Second Amendment creates an individual right and, to bear arms, and he respects the constitutional rights of Americans to do so. He's going to protect the rights of hunters and other law-abiding Americans to purchase, own, transport, and use guns.
That's right. And at the same time, he does say that, and you can debate the rhetoric of that or not. But the other thing about President-elect Obama is he is the commander-in-chief, mm-hmm. and he does have the responsibility to protect the national security of the United States. And you cannot talk about that in a thoughtful, systematic way without dealing with assault rifles that are being trafficked to Mexico, that is essentially arming the drug war. You can't.
What about the gun show loophole? That drives me crazy, Scott.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the critical issues right now. Right now, what we really need, in terms of if you took a step back and thought of what's the one policy that we probably need to really effectively clamp down on illegal guns and gun trafficking and gun violence, it's basically mandating a background check, a very common sense way, a background check on every gun sold in America.
Right. Which now, we have in gun stores, however, gun shows get the free pass, don't they?
That's right. I mean, like, there's sort of a patchwork effect around the states. But in other words, if you went to a gun store, gun dealer, they would ask you to fill out the form, and you would run your name through the national instant check system, and they would find out, are you a domestic abuser or are you a felon? If you went to a gun show, most likely, depending on the state, but most likely, or through just a classified ad, you could show up with the cash and buy the gun. There's no incentive, essentially, for a gun seller to run that check, as it were.
So do we have any statistics on how many guns are being bought in stores as opposed to gun shows, to use the loophole at this point?
One of the critical issues, of course, is how do we know in terms of the data. There's some indication that around, you know, a third, 40% that are sold on the secondary market, as we say. What's interesting to me is we're very thoughtful about this. It's so interesting because how you feel about the Second Amendment is not that relevant to us, in all honesty. We have an opinion about it, but it's not the critical issue. For us, the issue is, if you're going to purchase and possess a weapon, we should at least find out, are you a felon? Are you a terrorist? Are you a wife? A domestic abuser? Are you
Are you a threat to our national security, exactly, and our family's security?
And sort of, we equate it to the metaphor I often use is airport security.
Hmm.
When you go through an airport, you take off your shoes. Everyone does this. It's sort of a shared sacrifice. It's kind of we don't necessarily like it, but we take our laptop computers out, take our shoes off, and go through security. We're all safer because of it. We get on airplanes and know that, for the most part, that the person sitting next to us doesn't have a gun, a knife. We all do it. It doesn't take that much. I mean, I live in Chicago. I go to O'Hare.
I'm sorry.
Airport. But it's something you do. We all do it. And it's a thoughtful, just comprehensive way by which we're all safer. Well, we kind of look at the same way as guns. By running a background check, just a thoughtful, sensible policy. If you buy a gun, your name gets run through a comprehensive system to make sure you're not a felon or a threat, as you said, or mentally ill, for example. It's not the end-all be-all. But it's at least one way to reduce access to guns.
One of the other issues, Scott, that I want to bring up before we run out of time here is the issue of the illegal gun market and how we have seen the surplus of supply of guns in this country create the black market of guns we see, where guns are used in crimes where they are obtained illegally.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of it. I mean, what I think people need to understand is we're looking at our country. There's some estimates, they vary. We're looking at about a 300 million amount of weapons in private circulation.
Wow.
And if you look at this, we call it sort of the law of large numbers. Those are a lot of weapons.
Yeah.
And inevitably, even a small percentage of those are going to wind up in the wrong hands in urban centers like Chicago, Philadelphia, New York, Los Angeles. They're going to be trafficked and traded by either drug dealers or gangbangers. I mean, any number of people, gun traffickers going internationally, for example. So at some point, what I think needs to happen, and we have hope, and certainly it's a difficult political environment for Barack Obama because there's a lot of Democrats and Republicans who have no interest in dealing with the gun violence epidemic in the United States. But nonetheless, it's incumbent upon him to take strong action, I think, and think about what can he do in the short term and the long term to get a handle on this problem, because it's certainly not going to go away.
Scott, I think you bring up two very basic, obvious things that we can do. Close the gun show loophole, and number two, do something to control the supply of guns that has created the black market of guns that we have seen with people purchasing guns illegally. I think even legal gun owners can agree that they'd want guns out of the hands of those that obtained it illegally.
Well, that's exactly right. And what's interesting is that the American people have been won over. I mean, gun owners and certainly the far majority of the American public support gun regulations and support gun control. And it really is this very small, well-funded, well-organized fringe agenda from the gun lobby and the NRA that have stopped reform. And I think it, hopefully, moving forward, now that we have a problem solver president, as he likes to call himself, that maybe we'll get to the point where we start solving problems instead of debating ideology and look at real systemic problems.
Scott Vogel, someday when we got the time, we got to sit down on the radio and just spend an hour talking about John Lott.
I would. I would love it anytime.
Or should I say Mary Rosh? That story is awesome. The author of More Guns, Less Crime. Fascinating figure, somebody you should look up for yourself. I think now you can see him at the American Enterprise Institute. But in his day, he was in Chicago, wasn't he, when he came up with
he had a brief stint, that's right.
The bogus study of more guns, less crime, which everybody uses?
That raises a good point, too. One hope we have is that President-elect Obama will start using real evidence in his decision-making, and that might lead to some effective gun violence prevention measures.
Scott Vogel, GunGuys.com. Thank you, as always. Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
You're listening to guest host Lee Rayburn, filling in for Tom Hartman.
Sitting in for Tom Hartman today. Thank you for being with me in the best 3 hours of my day, every chance I get the opportunity to be with you. Broadcasting from the Air America affiliate in Madison, Wisconsin, the Mike 92.1, where I have a little morning show, and I'll be back with you tomorrow here on the Tom Hartman Show. Our phones have been busted today, so I apologize if I didn't get to your call, but that should pave the way for very interesting caller segments tomorrow. I want to wrap things up with, and I can't help it, it started. I didn't want to start it this early, but it's going already. Hey, I'll give you a hint. Every single commercial for Christmas has this damn song. I don't know, the Carol of the Bells, is that what it is? It's become this carol of commercials now for me, and it is driving me nuts already. I believe that you can't go a commercial break. Maybe we just went with a commercial break without hearing it, and that would be a fortunate set of circumstances. But not only has a holiday shopping season started a bit early this year, but also the war on the war on Christmas has started a bit early this year. It was Bill O'Reilly just the days after the presidential election, trying hard not to talk about President-elect Barack Obama and his art of compromise and his coming together with the likes of John McCain as they did today. Bill O'Reilly was at a loss of things to talk about, so where did he go? The war on Christmas. Yeah, it started for Bill O'Reilly right after the election, but it started for Focus on the Family in April. In April. Listen, I am as upset as everybody else about this prop hate that passed in California, an unprecedented moment in American history, where on the same day where we elect the first black president, happens to be the same day where an unprecedented move in a ballot initiative in California, we actually strip rights away from Americans where we're going the wrong way. Unprecedented. Doesn't happen like that. It would be like, oh, now the slaves are free. Wait, we took it back. Yeah, now you can get married no matter what your family looks like. No, wait, we took it back. So I, this year, have committed myself to waging the war on Christmas. Not because I hate the Jesus, not because I'm an atheist in a foxhole. No, because what they have used is God in vain. It violated one of their own Ten Commandments written by God himself. They've used the Lord's name in vain in order to justify their own hatred, their own homophobia. By the way, the Journal of Abnormal Psychology details how homophobia is deeply rooted in homosexual desires. Yeah, so if you hate the gays, you might want to try one before you figure it out. Just go out there and see what you can get. This year, the Focus on the Family, another anti-gay group, has kicked off their War on Christmas campaign, and they kicked it off on Easter. Easter! This is a long budding campaign, and you can go to the Focus on the Family site today so you can figure out who's naughty and who's nice. This is wonderful. The ministry's political action arm from Focus on the Family launched its second annual holiday campaign, posting online shopper's guides, giving three categories to Christian-friendly shoppers. You can shop at Christmas-friendly retailers, Christmas-negligent retailers, or you can do what I'm doing this holiday season and shop at Christmas-offensive retailers. First of all, you are going to see me on Bill O'Reilly before the holiday season is out. I can almost guarantee it, because right now we are in pre-production of my brand-new Christmas carol. I think it's going to take off like a bat out of hell. You ready for this? Let's kick the Christ out of Christmas. Right? Take that, Bill O'Reilly. You want a war? I'll give you a war. Let's kick the Christ out of Christmas. It's it's sung to the same tune with Let's Put the Spring Back in Springfield from The Simpsons. Anyway, focus on we'll see how that goes over. Probably like a lead balloon. If you are looking to shop at Christmas offensive stores this year, you can do no better than going to the Focus on the Family website, find those Christmas offensive retailers, and making sure you shop at them. I'm going to get my winter coat there this year. My name is Lee Rayburn. It's been a pleasure to be with you this afternoon. I'll be back again tomorrow.
If you are so inclined, you may want to do as I do and write your own Christmas carol. Or just go to Focus on the Family and shop at Christmas Offensive Retailers. By the way, Christmas Offensive Retailers, they're offensive because they say Happy Holidays. Well, Happy Holidays to all of you. Even you, little Timmy. Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman. We'll see you again tomorrow right here on Air America Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.